Bloomberg Surveillance with Ken Pruitt and Tom Keene. If you're listening via our new Radio Plus iPhone app, did you know you can browse through recent podcasts according to show, or you can sort by companies discussed, even by the name of the guests? If you don't have the Radio Plus iPhone app yet, you'll want to download it. It's free via the iTunes App Store.
Joining us now, Robert Shiller, as he looks at his index. It's nice to see a better number all in all, 1.90%. As you and Carl Case look through the data, why did we get a better report today?
I never know these answers with certainty. It kind of puzzles me. So there are signs of strength. So, for example, the National Association of Home Builders Housing Market Index has been up for several months now. There seems to be some, and confidence is up. Why they're up is one of those mystery questions.
There were some big jump moves. One of them was not New York. The month-over-month statistic, which your colleague Carl Case looks at so much, New York was really flat, up just 0.1%. Better moves in Boston, but particularly large moves in Phoenix, Washington, D.C., Portland, Seattle, Cleveland, San Francisco up 3.4%. When you look at the data, was it skewed towards certain metropolitan areas, or was it all boats rising?
It's not all boats rising. I can only speculate about what's happening here. It seems like this a number of the cities that have done the best have been glamour cities. And cities that have had...
Is New Haven a glamour city?
We think so.
But it's been the glamour cities.
But people have the speculative fervor. It comes back. San Francisco is the arch example, and that's our best performing city this month.
A three-month annualized, Ken, of San Francisco. Are you ready? 15.99%. Right. A 16% three-month annualized return, not far behind Dallas with a 14% three-month annualized return.
Can I add, San Francisco, between 2009 and 2010, went up almost 20%. And so, but then it fizzled, and then they're going down again. So, you know, I think they're kind of volatile out there in the Bay Area.
Phoenix has also been kind of a boom-bust
sort of
city, too, right? One of the mysteries about housing in San Francisco, I was driving around a few years ago at the Pacific Heights. At the time, it was like the most expensive residential area in America. No doormen in those apartment buildings. Apparently, it's just a New York thing, and no doormen.
Well, there are cultural differences. New York is different. Yeah, you picture a doorman and a little poodle.
Sure. Oh, we're talking housing and poodle in New York. Good morning to everyone on Bloomberg Television as well. Robert Shiller with us. As we look at the surprise of this, and you talk about San Francisco as a glamour city, is the Sun Belt getting any glamour when we hear the trauma of Phoenix, the trauma of Florida? Are they finally turning it around?
Well, I think that San Francisco, California has had a historically volatile market going back decades. If you go to Miami, they had a volatile market in the 1920s. Remember the Florida land boom?
Yeah.
And then it seemed to just quiet down and was dead there for a half century.
To rip up the script, I just finished up Tom Levinson's wonderful book on Isaac Newton. Isaac Newton lost a lot in the South Sea land bubble. You've written about
this.
The stock bubble, rather. You've written about this. Are we done with our irrational exuberance, or are we in an irrational exuberance right now in the bond market?
Oh, in the bond market. Something seems amiss in the bond market. But I don't know. The word irrational exuberance was more placed on people thinking they were going to get rich quick, right? I mean, you get excited. Some market is just taking off. And I don't know that people think that the bond yields are going to go down dramatically more now. So it's not a get-rich-quick type enthusiasm.
Psychologically, do we want to return to housing as a 2%, 3% a year return, or should we think about housing being an equivalent to a stock market investment where we hope for a better total return?
I think housing is a very different investment because the benefits are largely in kind. It's a question, do you want to consume the house? Do you want to consume the services that a house provides? And people lose track of that, and they think that historically, there's a huge difference between the housing market and the stock market. If you're going to live in a house and you don't want to, you don't want those services, you're doing it just for investment gains. That is a loser investment.
Of course,
a terrible loser investment for the last century.
On the other hand, stocks and bonds won't keep the rain off your head. I mean, there's
different
ways to look at it.
I think investing in a house is a wonderful idea if you have a family, if you want stability, you want your children to have neighbors and a school, good school system. All those reasons are wonderful reasons to buy a house, but not as an investment, purely as an investment.
Look, everybody's family has a story about, say, Grandpa who came back from the war and put $50 down on a GI home, and he and Grandma traded up every few years, and they ended up with a really nice house, and all they'd ever put in was that initial $50. Are those days completely gone now?
Well, you're referring partly to the leverage that you can get investing in a home. So there are going to be stories like that of lucky people who timed the market and traded up. But that, you know, leverage has a downside too, and that's what we're discovering right now.
We still are not out of the woods. We are muddling along. Still a negative statistic year over year on your Case-Shiller series, rather. Do we need a public policy now, or is it too late for a public policy?
Well, I think that right now people are hoping, it's called wishful thinking, hoping that this rally that we're seeing will be big and sustained, and it will bail us out of all of our problems. The market could, in principle, bail us out, but I think that's too much hope and not enough action.
You have new work you're working on, which is our behavior about our long-term view on real estate. Give us a preliminary look.
Well, Chip Case and I have been working on surveys of home buyers for 10 years now. And one of the most striking trends is that since 2004, long-term expectations for home prices have been declining. We ask people what they think will happen over the next 10 years. And those expectations have just been down, 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 steadily.
Why? Is it all the ancillary costs, taxes, upkeep, a new roof?
I think it's the aftermath of the enthusiasm, the bubble. 2004 was the height of the housing bubble, and people got extravagantly, it was irrational exuberance in the housing market. But it didn't just go away, and this crisis didn't erase it either. It's just been gradually, we're just losing our hopes gradually.
Okay, but then you overlay on that not only a good society, like your new book, thank you to the New York Times for writing you up this week, but is it that we have a bad society?
No, I don't. That was meant in jest,
We don't have the incentives that are out there.
Yeah, I shouldn't. We are living, this is my book, Finance and the Good Society. We are living in an age of financial capitalism. And it troubles the soul a little bit to see how all these markets drive our lives. But I think this is where we are, and I think it is a good society, and it can be made better.
Mm-hmm. Bloomberg Businessweek had a really good story in the current issue about young people. One of the things we know about housing is that married people buy, basically, right? Single people rent, married people buy. People, because of the economy, young people postponing all sorts of decisions, including having children. The birth rate is down, I think they said 11% over the past 3 years or so, which really has some long-term implications, doesn't it?
Same thing happened in the Great Depression.
Yeah.
In fact, that shows how deep the angst is caused by this crisis. Mm. Mm-hmm. People are postponing such fundamental things as having a family.
Yeah. Well, I think women born in 1908 had the lowest number of children per female because they hit the peak childbearing years during the Depression. You know, it makes sense. Yeah. Extra mouth to feed was a serious problem back then. But do you see housing get back? What year do you want to pick that was, quote, normal? 04, 05?
That wasn't normal, no. 95, let's
95.
say. 95. Yes.
So when do we get back to those days?
In terms of levels of prices, we're not quite back. I'd have to check this. But in terms of, we're a long way from back to the just kind of even keel sense of normal optimism that we had back then.
Bob, I want to digress here a little bit. As I've said many times, one of the great photos of modern economics is a very young, squeaky clean Robert Shiller sitting in a room in Europe with all the greats that you studied under in the 20th century. We lost really the last of her generation in Anna Schwartz dying this week at 96 years old. For our audience worldwide, why was Anna Schwartz's work so important to economics and to America's understanding of the Depression?
Well, I think the major work in her life was the Monetary History of the United States
with Milton Friedman.
And that's a long and detailed history of monetary policy in the United States. I read it years ago with great enthusiasm because it seemed to be out of sync with the kind of mathematical modeling approach that was very common, well, it still is, and of course it has importance. But we need also to read history. And these were people who read history. And they look, I think the interesting thing in that book is that they talk about, I think the word was quasi-controlled experiments. They were thinking like scientists. A scientist wants to do a controlled experiment, but we can't do those with the economy. But Friedman and Schwartz saw a number of episodes that they judged were sufficiently random, where monetary policy changed because they read the history, right? And they knew that there was some quixotic change in the decision-making of the Fed.
Mm-hmm.
And so they pursued that. I thought that was really showed real insight.
And it was way early. We forget how early they were. I mean, that book was written decades and decades ago.
I think that in intellectual life, there are fashions and fads, just like there are in the markets.
Mm.
And people will succeed in intellectual endeavors who stay above those fashions and fads.
Yeah.
So we'll always need mathematical economics, and we'll always need historical economics. So when most people are doing one of them, you do the other.
You go the other way. Bob Shiller, thank you so much. It sounded like a commencement address right there from Bob Shiller's new book, Finance and a Good Society.
Listen to Bloomberg Surveillance weekday mornings at 7 Eastern on Bloomberg 1130 in New York or on Sirius and XM Satellite Radio Channel 113. Copyright 2012.